All right, welcome. This is episode 646 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. Today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the Free 86 series for Step 2, Step 3. This is going to be Series 8. All right, I'm going to pick up from question 67. A four-day-old female, Greek-American newborn, is brought to the office by her mother because the infant developed yellowing of her skin one day after hospital discharge and approximately 20 red spots over her skin yesterday. The infant has continued to feed well. Pregnancy and delivery were uncomplicated. Birth weight was 3,400 grams, 7 pounds, 8 ounces, 50th percentile. Apgar scores were 8 and 9 at 1 and 5 minutes respectively. The mother, Gravida 2 para 2, has blood group A, Rh positive. The neonate's blood group is O, Rh positive. Results of a direct antiglobulin, that's a Coombs test, was negative. The neonate was breastfeeding and was doing well at the time of discharge. Weight today is 3250 grams, that's 7 pounds, 2 ounces, 25th percentile. Physical examination discloses jaundice and scleral ictus. Many papules containing small vesicles with clear to slightly turbid fluid are present over the newborn's face, trunk, and extremities. No organomegaly or adenopathy is noted. Serum total bilirubin concentration is 8.7 mg per deciliter, and serum conjugated direct bilirubin concentration is 0.7 mg per deciliter. So question 67 says, in addition to scheduling a follow-up visit in 1 week, which of the following is the most appropriate next step regarding the newborn's jaundice? So option A says, advise the mother to avoid eating foods containing large quantities of carotene. B says, begin administering small doses of phenobarbital to the newborn. C says, recommend discontinuation of breastfeeding until the jaundice has disappeared. D says, recommend home phototherapy for the newborn. E says, recommend no change in child care or feeding of the newborn. I'm going to go with option E here, right? This child has physiologic jaundice. You know, usually it arises after the first 24 hours of life. It's going to peak within a few days and then it's going to go down, right? And this child, since it's the first week of life, is probably breastfeeding jaundice, right? So typically that's just jaundice that arises because the baby is not feeding enough. Is not eating enough, which is not unusual, right? You're a four-day-old, mom is still figuring out how to breastfeed and all that stuff. So that's why the bilirubin is high. It's almost like a bilirubin concentration effect in a sense, right? So it's 8.7, the child is fine, right? This child is 4 days old, that's like 96 hours old. We don't start doing phototherapy and any of that in a 96-hour-old until their total bilirubin is like 20 milligrams per deciliter or higher, right? So we're not going to do that here, right? That's kind of ridiculous, right? So option E is the right answer. Home phototherapy. Phototherapy we done in a hospital setting, right? Not at home. And then discontinue breastfeeding. No, you should actually breastfeed the child more. Give phenobarbital to the newborn. No, right? To increase UDP glucuronosyl transferase activity. No, you don't need to do that. Advise the mom to avoid eating foods containing large amounts of carotene. No, right? And this jaundice, again, is physiologic because it arose after 24 hours of life and it's indirect, right? Remember, physiologic jaundice is never direct hyperbilirubinemia. All right. Now, question 68 says, which of the following is the most appropriate management for the newborn's rash? Again, what rash does this newborn have? It's red, you know, has an erythematous base, you know, small vesicles. It's on the face, the trunk, and the extremities, right? This is ETN, right? Erythema toxicum neonatorum. Again, usually peaks within a few days of life, and then usually within by like 2 weeks or whatever, it just resolves on its own. So it's not a big deal. Don't do anything here. Again, you see most of this question is benign. You really should be picking a benign answer, right? So option A says 0.5% hydrocortisone cream applied twice daily. No. Daily wet to dry povidone iodine. Soaks with gauze pads on each vesicle. No. Polymixing ointment applied twice daily. No. Routine skincare with soap and water. Yeah, that's a benign answer. I'll pick D. Option E says scrubbing daily with Entsufon cleanser firmly enough to unroof the vesicles. I've not even heard of Entsufon before. I don't know what that is. You have to look that up on your own. But option D makes sense here. All right. Question 69. A 6-month-old male Hispanic infant is brought to the office by his parents because of intermittent swelling of his right scrotum that is more pronounced when he cries. The swelling has never been red or stuck. Vital signs are normal. A right inguinal hernia is confirmed on physical examination. In discussing repair of the hernia with the parents, you should inform them which of the following, right? So this Hispanic infant, right? Like if we look at this, this looks like an inguinal hernia, right? And what kind of inguinal hernia is this likely going to be? I'd hope you're saying divine. This is probably an indirect inguinal hernia. This is probably an indirect inguinal hernia, right? Remember, indirect inguinal hernias are very common in little kids. And we tend to find it more commonly in males. We tend to find it more commonly in males. Males, people that were born preterm, and it's usually going to be on the right side, right? Because the pathophys, as we know, involves a persistent patency of the processus vaginalis. And the thing is, you know, there is obviously a right processus vaginalis and a left processus vaginalis. And the one on the right side tends to close later than the one on the left side, right? So if it's patent, then the abdominal contents can come through that road. Because remember, the processus vaginalis, I like to think of it as a highway that connects the abdomen to the testicles, right? So you can, to the scrotum. So you can basically have like, if that highway is open, then abdominal contents can come through the highway, right? From the abdomen to the scrotum, right? And the thing is, for this, you want to fix them. The way you manage inguinal hernias is kind of different from the way you manage umbilical hernias. Umbilical hernias, you can wait till close on its own in most cases. But an inguinal hernia, especially an inguinal hernia in a little kid, a child that's like less than a year old, you want to try to close it electively, right? You want to schedule the surgery because the thing is, especially in kids under age one, they have a pretty high risk of incarceration and strangulation, right? So you wanna fix it. It's not crazy high, but you wanna fix it. You don't wanna just leave it dangling or whatever. So you wanna fix it if you can, right? So let's look at the right answer. So option A says heniurophy can be postponed until age 2 years because many hernias close spontaneously. Again, the risk of incarceration, strangulation, and death is high, so you don't wanna do that. Option B says heniurophy can be postponed until age 12 years because oligospermia does not develop before age 12. I would not do that. Option C says heniurophy should be scheduled at the earliest convenient time. Okay, that seems like a reasonable answer. Option D says heniurophy should be scheduled as an emergency operation. No, right? Deal with a mess first. Prevent a mess instead of cleaning up a mess. So deal with it sooner rather than later, right? Don't wait until it becomes an emergency. That doesn't make any sense, right? Option E says there's no need to repair the hernia in childhood unless incarceration occurs. No. You want to repair it. The thing is, when a child that is more than a year old that has lived for a few years of life has an inguinal hernia, the risk of incarceration strangulation is low, actually. But for a child that's like less than a year old, the risk of incarceration strangulation is pretty high. So you want to fix it. It's not an emergency operation, but you want to fix it. It's an elective procedure, but you want to fix it. All right. Now, question. So the right answer is going to be option C for that one. All right. Question 70. 3 weeks ago, a 45-year-old man was admitted to the hospital because of frostbite of both feet. He was treated by rapid rewarming and protective care of the feet. All the toes on the right foot have turned black. That's not good. He has become slightly febrile and progressively more confused over the last few days. Examination discloses cellulitis in the midfoot. Which of the following is the most appropriate treatment? This guy has gangrene, right? I can see many things going wrong here, like, I don't know, like neck fash or compartment syndrome or sepsis and death. So option A says amputation. I'd probably pick that one, right? Get rid of that bad foot. Option B says application of topical collagenase. That's like a thing that kind of breaks down collagen. That's not going to help with gangrene. Option C says debridement of necrotic skin. Seems like the problem involves more than the skin, so I'm not going to pick that. Option D says hyperbaric oxygen. Again, gangrene has happened. Necrosis of the tissue has happened. You need to amputate. E says whirlpool therapy. No, the right answer is A. You're going to amputate that extremity. All right. Okay. Now, question 71 says a 44-year-old African-American construction worker comes to the emergency department because of excruciating left flank pain that radiates to his left testicle. He describes the pain as occurring in waves and says, "This is the worst pain I've had in my life. And that includes closing my thumb at my truck door." He's extremely restless and is in obvious pain. Genitalia are normal. Abdominal examination discloses intermittent guarding with spasms of pain. Plain x-ray of the abdomen shows no abnormalities. Results of urinalysis are shown. So the pH 6.5, specific gravity 1.025, glucose negative, protein negative. Of course, they neglect to show us the red cells. NBMEs. All right, so urinary sediment is shown. Which of the following is the most appropriate diagnostic study? Option A says CT scan of the abdomen, B says CT scan of the kidney, C says culture of the urine, D says determination of serum uric acid concentration, E says measurement of 24-hour urinary calcium excretion. This person's got a kidney stone, right? The abdominal film did not show you anything. Well, how do we find kidney stones? We find kidney stones with CTs, right? Non-contrast CTs. Remember, you use a non-contrast CT because if you use contrast, you'll obfuscate the stone and you'll be able to see it. So option C is wrong, right? Urine culture, that's for UTI. That's not what's going on here. D says checking serum uric acid concentration. E says checking urinary calcium excretion. Again, let me help you. You don't really need to do that, right? You don't really need to do that. Like, the direct way you diagnose a kidney stone is by doing a CT. So we have two kinds of CTs here. We have a CT of the abdomen and a CT of the kidney. So you're like, those two answers are correct. No, they're not. Only one is correct, right? So remember, will kidney stones always be at the kidneys? No, right? There are many places they can be. They can be in the kidneys, they can be in the ureters, they can be in the renal pelvis, they can be in many different places. So between a CT of the abdomen and a CT of the kidney, which one is going to give you a more complete visualization of the urinary system? I would hope you're saying CT scan of the abdomen, right? So the right answer is going to be option A. It's not going to be option B. All right. Because option B only shows you the kidneys, option A shows you the kidneys and the entire renal collecting system. All right. Or urinary collecting system. All right. So question 72 says a 52-year-old woman who has had low back pain for several years is admitted to the hospital because the pain has suddenly worsened. Her current medications include oxycodone, amitriptyline, perphenazine, fluoxetine, and trazodone. The patient's body weight is 10% below ideal weight. Pupils are constricted and skin turgor is poor. She seems sluggish and her speech is slow. Neurologic examination and x-rays of the lumbosacral spine disclose no abnormalities. If a medication is responsible for this patient's mental condition, the medication is most likely to be which of the following? So we see this person has constricted pupils. You don't say. She's sluggish. Her speech is slow. All right. Let's look at this. So option A says amitriptyline. Well, we know that's a TCA. TCAs have anticholinergic properties, right? So they cause papillary mydriasis, not meiosis. So that's wrong. Option B says fluoxetine. Well, fluoxetine does not cause ocular findings. Option C says oxycodone. Oxycodone is an opioid. Opioids can cause papillary meiosis because they decrease norepinephrine release at the adrenergic synapse. So that seems right. Let's keep that. Perphenazine, I believe, is an antipsychotic. Antipsychotics, especially the first generation low potency antipsychotics, they also have anticholinergic effects, right? Remember, your tricyclic antidepressants and your first generation low potency antipsychotics, they have those anti-HAM effects, anti-H1, so they can cause sedation, anti-alpha-1, so they can cause orthostasis, and anti-muscarinic. Right, anti-M1, so they can cause anti-muscarinic, anticholinergic effects, right? So option D will cause papillary mydriasis. That's not what's going on here. Trazodone is kind of a weak opioid. But again, between oxycodone and trazodone, which one is a more powerful opioid, more likely to cause these systemic effects? I'm going to go with option C, right? So yeah, oxycodone makes the most sense for this person. All right, so I'm going to go to question 73. A 65-year-old man is admitted to the hospital after he has an inferior wall myocardial infarction. 48 hours later, his vital signs are stable. ECG is shown. The most appropriate course of action is to do which of the following? All right. A says administer atropine. B says administer isoproterenol. C says begin synchronized cardioversion. D says insert a pacemaker. E says observe. All right. Let's look at this EKG. Okay. Okay, that kind of makes sense. So first things first, let's look at the rate, right? So we can see between the QRS complexes, how many boxes do we have? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, well, like about 6. So his heart rate is pretty low. It's probably about 50. So he's got a bradycardia. He has maybe a bradyarrhythmia. All right. Now let's look at the PR intervals, right? Because again, if the USMLE is, again, just think in odds on your exams, right? I feel like people like to overcomplicate their lives. Just think in odds on your exams. If the USMLEs are testing a bradyarrhythmia, which one do you think they're going to go for first? Probably some kind of AV block, right? So whenever I see a person has bradycardia, the next thing I think about on my exam is, gee, divine, let's look at the PR intervals. Well, we'll look at the first PR interval, we'll look at the second one, we'll look at the third one, we'll look at the fourth one. We can see the PR intervals are getting longer and longer and longer and longer, and then, boom, QRS disappears. So what kind of AV block is that? That's going to be second degree. Which one? Mobitz 1, right? Winky Bach, Mobitz 1. Do you do anything for a Mobitz 1 AV block? Nope. Especially if they're asymptomatic. If they have symptoms, then yes, you can pace them, but this person doesn't have any symptoms, so we're not going to do anything, right? So I'm not going to be doing atropine. We use atropine when a person has a symptomatic bradycardia. And you notice that pacing is not even a supplied answer. I'm not going to do that. Isoproterenol is a beta 1 and beta 2 agonist. There's no reason to do that. This person literally has no symptoms. He's completely fine. Synchronized cardioversion is typically for tachyarrhythmias, not bradyarrhythmias. Insert a pacemaker again. That's for people that have a Mobitz 2 or complete heart blocks. That's third degree. And typically, Mobitz 2 and third degree heart blocks tend to be associated with LAD infarcts, okay? Anterior MIs. Inferior wall MIs, RC infarcts tend to be associated with Mobitz 1. And those tend to be transient, right? Usually within a few days, it'll kind of go away, you know, as the ischemia and everything resolves, right? So I'm not going to put a pacemaker, right? Like, I'm not going to put a pacemaker. So option E makes sense, right? The right answer is to observe. All right. So the answer is E. All right. So a healthy 2-year-old African-American child is brought to the office for a routine well child visit. The child was weaned at 6 months of age and began to walk at 10 months of age. On physical examination, she has mild bow legs, 10 degree genuvarum. The parent should be advised about which of the following. Again, this child is fine. Coming for a routine visit, right? And then the USMLE is, you know, she started walking at 10 months. She's crushing it motor-wise. Mild bow legs. Guys, pick a benign answer here. Don't overthink this thing. Option A says braces should be applied immediately. No. Option B says no treatment is needed at this time. Yes. I'm going to pick option B. Option C says surgical correction is necessary. Come on, for mild bow legs? No. Option D says the child's intake of vitamin D should be increased. Do we see any indications of rickets in this child? Vitamin D deficiency? Nope. Special exercise program is needed. We don't need that right now, right? Again, most times bow legs will resolve within like, you know, 2 to 3 years or whatever, right? You know, this child is just a 2-year-old. It will likely resolve. It's just a part of development. It's not a big deal, you know. If the person has lived for, you know, maybe longer than 3 years, they're like 4 or 5 year olds, they still have bow legs, or they have like very severe bow legs, then you can maybe do exercises and things like that, or bracing, but you don't need to do that right now. This child is fine. This child is just a 2-year-old. Chill out. I'm going to go with option B for this one. All right. Yeah, that's the thing. I feel like many times people overcomplicate the USMLE exams. They're actually fairly straightforward if you don't overcomplicate things for yourself. All right. Question 75 says a 3-year-old child is brought to the ED by his teenage sister because he refuses to walk. Okay. The sister reports that she has been babysitting for 3 days while her parents are away on a trip. What? And that the boy has been fussy for the past 2 days. Physical examination is normal except for a painful swelling of the left lower leg. In addition to radiography of the leg, you should obtain which of the following? Man, this story is not adding up. What kind of parent? Goodness gracious. What kind of parent leaves a 3-year-old in the care of a teenager? Okay, maybe 2 hours. I understand that. Hey, we gotta go grab ice cream or something. But for 3 days? Wow. Okay, this story is not adding up. There is something strange going on here. Well, let's look at the answer choices here. Option A says abdominal ultrasound. B says CT scan of the abdomen. C says CT scan of the head. D says skeletal survey. E says serum lead concentration. So what do you think is going on here? Whenever you have a story in a kid that does not add up, we're kind of worried about child abuse here, right? Kind of worried about child abuse. So this child has a problem in the lower extremity. Maybe they have issues in other bones. I'd do a skeletal survey, right? The thing is, you want to be really careful about ordering CT scans in kids, right? There's a three-year-old. Why give him that big dose of radiation, right? So I certainly will not do options B or C. And then option A, abdominal ultrasound. Well, the thing is, again, the question is directly focused on the musculoskeletal system. Why don't we examine that first before we start looking at the abdomen, right? And then option E says serum lead concentration, because remember, lead can cause abdominal pain, it can cause like wrist drop, foot drop, it can cause neuropathy and all those things. But again, it will probably not arise this suddenly, right? That doesn't really make sense. So I'm going to go with option D for this one, right? A skeletal survey is basically like an x-ray, like a series of like 20 x-rays. I know, sounds like a lot of radiation, but it's not as much as a straight up CT, right? So it's like a series of 20 x-rays, you assess the major bones of the body just to make sure that, hey, there's no kind of like non-accidental trauma going on here, right? So I'm going to go with option D, right? This story just does not add up. It just does not add up. All right. Now, question 76, our last question today. A 32-year-old man and his 29-year-old wife come to the office for evaluation for infertility. The wife's gynecologist has reported that her anatomic and physiologic evaluation disclosed no abnormalities and that assessment of potential male factors is needed. The husband is 188 centimeters. He's 6'3" tall with fair skin and little facial hair. He has mild gynecomastia and small firm testicles. No sperm are seen on semen analysis. Which of the following tests is most likely to establish the underlying cause of this couple's infertility? Well, the wife seems fine, but what do you think the husband has? Tall guy, gynecomastia, small testicles, right? Not making enough androgens, right? So they have like decreased pubic and axillary hair. It's probably Klinefelter's, right? Klinefelter's, right? 47XXY. So, okay, let's see what was going to help us here. So option A says karyotype from peripheral leukocytes. Sounds reasonable. Let's keep that. Option B says serum estrogen and testosterone concentrations. No, that's not going to be specific for anything, right? Option C says serum FSH and LH concentrations. That's not going to be specific for anything because the question is saying which of the following tests is most likely to establish the underlying cause of this couple's infertility. Option D says serum prolactin concentration. No, prolactin doesn't explain this guy being this tall. No, that doesn't make any sense. Option E says testicular ultrasound. No. This person has Klinefelter's. You're going to see it very well with karyotyping. So I'm going to go to option A for this. All right, so we're going to stop here. Again, you like the way I teach, you're going to love my classes even more. So I have a bunch of classes for this month taking place starting on the 9th, right? So starting this Thursday, for step 1 to 3, there's a test taking class, a biostats class, and a social science class. And then for step 2 and step 3, there's a last minute review and a 20-hour class. And then in the month of June, first 2 weeks of June, I have a 20-hour step 2, step, I have a 50-hour, sorry, step 2, step 3 review. And then I guess in the month of July, if you're a person that is starting residency, internal medicine residency, or you're graduating from residency and you're taking your internal medicine boards or you're recertifying, I have a 50-hour ABIM review that's coming up. All right. If you're interested, I've made podcasts where I talk about those classes and what you should expect from them. Or if you want more information, shoot me an email. Again, these classes are not lectures. I use problem sets to go over content, explain pathophysiology, make integrations, show you how that information is presented on exams. And then also, I offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLEs and Comlex exams. And then I also have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify. I've got a YouTube channel you can check out. And then I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. You know, many of you know I'm a Christ follower, so every week I post like one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective I address a life lesson. I uploaded episode 387, I believe, yesterday. And there's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. There's actually many people that listen to those and find them to be extremely helpful. I get emails from people all the time on those. All right, so thank you for listening to me today. I will see you, God willing, episode 647, I think. And I believe that should be the last part of our series on the 386, so we can move on to something else. All right, so have a wonderful day. I'll see you next time. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.